This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 17 for Thursday, July 23rd, 2009, Art Research. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store.
Welcome to another edition of Out of Line After Hours. And joining me in the studio, as always, Peter DeLorenzo, Mr. Auto Extremist.
In a suit.
Inappropriately
dressed.
But you said you came from a business meeting.
Yeah, but I'm back.
You're back. And it's after hours, so at least you loosened the tie up.
Yeah, I loosened the tie. But, you know, once you're here, it's kind of you're committed.
I almost didn't recognize you.
I know. Well, I could have been in my riding attire, which is usually some bad shorts and a T-shirt.
But. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you're going to write, you got to be in the right frame of mind.
Absolutely.
You can't be uptight in a suit and,
I don't know,
and do any writing. And, of course, we've got Jeff Gilbert from WWJ News Radio 950.
And I was the guy that got the email saying, don't wear a suit tonight. This is informal.
So you're appropriately dressed. You have a nice casual
WWJ logo on there because they say get the call letters out everywhere you can.
Yeah. Hey, I'm all for that. I do it every chance I get to the station. But great having you back.
Thanks. Last time I Skyped in from the far reaches of Northville.
Right, yeah. Which is only just minutes away
from
there. And also joining us is Art Spinella from CNW Marketing in Bandon, Oregon. Welcome, Art.
Well, hey, thanks, John. Peter.
So
everybody,
yeah, everybody. But so, Art, give us the quick thumbnail sketch. What is CNW Marketing, and who are you?
Well, number one, I'm a Detroiter. Number two, I've been kicking around the auto beat for it's been now, I hate to even say it, it's almost 40 years. CNW was started in 1983. I joined it later than that, started the auto office. We basically, what we do is we measure how people spend the money they have available to them, if they have any. And we look at all sorts of industries, not just automotive.
So how does a Detroiter end up in Bandon, Oregon? And where is Bandon?
You got there before the golf courses, right?
Yeah, way before the golf courses, yeah. Yeah, you know, wound up in Bandon because I was in Detroit on an assignment, and my wife came up to visit some friends and relatives up here, and she called me about 11 o'clock Detroit time, at 11 o'clock p.m. Detroit time, and said, gee, honey, guess what? I bought a house. And here I am. I had no idea where Bandon was. I had no idea hardly where Oregon was, so...
Cue the music. Cue the music, Art. Art, got to move away from there.
Yeah, so that's it. That's the short story.
Well, good. That's good. And we got a lot to talk tonight about because there's just so much news today. I can't believe it. Jeff and I were just talking about that a moment ago. But, Peter, let me throw it in your lap. What do you make of all these changes at General Motors, man? I mean, they are changing executives, and I can't believe what's going on there.
Well, I wasn't here last week, but you guys talked about Bob taking over the image management of the company, and he is basically instigating changes left and right. I mean, they're trying to demonstrate that it's not business as usual, and they're doing a real good job. I mean, taking Brian Nesbitt, A designer.
The guy who did the PT Cruiser.
And a bunch of other great stuff from Chrysler, and he's been at GM, and he's one of their stars. He has been plucked to run Cadillac. And that's, you know, that's not business as usual, folks. That is a monumental change in mindset. And Brent Dewar's being brought back from GM Europe to run Chevrolet. A lot of people have been moved.
Ed Pieper, who had been running Chevrolet, is now going to be doing sales
at Cadillac.
Very strange move there.
Yeah. So it's, I really am starting to believe that it's not business as usual down there.
But I'm wondering if they're redefining what all of these roles are. Will the top person at the brand be more of a marketing person, and like in Cadillac, where you have Nesmith as a heavy person who markets, he has the image, but you've got somebody who is a tried and tested salesperson below whom, who may not be Mr. Glamour and Ed Pieper, but he knows how to sell vehicles. So you, when you think of it that way, you think, okay, this is an interesting way to do something differently than it's already been done before, and maybe shake things up a bit.
Well, make no mistake, Bob's going to be the tiebreaker in anything. He's running the show. So, and Brian's going to have a lot to learn. You know, he's a designer and he's...
But so, obviously they think he can do more than just run a design staff.
Absolutely. And he'll tell you that too.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think there's no question that they're marching to the drum beats of Bob right now. So,
but, you know... And we've talked about how Chrysler is going to the CEOs of the brands, you know, that Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep will each have its own CEO with full P&L responsibility. And when I hear that somebody like Ed Pieper is moving away from running Chevrolet to being the sales manager for Cadillac, I think you're right, Jeff. I think we're seeing some changes to what those roles are all about.
Well, GM used to be Vehicle Sales, Service, and Marketing, the VSSM. That's been blown up completely. They have the marketing and image of the company are separate now, and the sales, they're still part of it, but they're sales and service. And lends itself to similar to other big companies like Nike. That's how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
The VSSM, I never really got that. And that's where a lot of bad things happened, in my estimation.
Apparently, they lost so much sales and market share. And let's get Art in on this. Art, you know, what do you make of GM putting a designer like Brian Nesbitt in charge of Cadillac?
Well, I think any kind of change like that is going to wind up being exactly what Peter said. It's going. It shows that there's at least a new thinking going on. Clearly, Lutz is in charge. What it reminds me of is the old days when each of the divisions had its own vice president and general manager, and these guys battled each other as much as they battled Ford or Chrysler at the time. And having that kind of control over having people in those positions that aren't necessarily coming out of the sales side of the business. Is actually pretty positive.
Yeah, and then the other interesting thing is only Brent Dewar is a vice president.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Susan Dougherty and Brian Nesbitt are general managers.
Well, they can evolve to become vice presidents if they're successful.
Exactly, yeah.
And what do you make of, what do you guys make? Gary Cowger leaving. He had been running manufacturing. Troy Clark had been in charge of North America. He's gone.
I wasn't as surprised with Gary Cowger because he's a little bit older. Troy Clark surprised me because Troy Clark looked like a rising star at the company, like he was on his way up. But, of course, he was tied heavily to Rick Wagner. So maybe the star didn't rise that much. And I don't know. It just shocked me that he was gone, but it didn't surprise me, Gary Cowger, because Gary, of course, was president of North America for a while. Then he went off to manufacturing, and you kind of figured that his star was not necessarily on the rise anymore.
Oh, no. In fact, I saw it as a big demotion for Gary. You know, he had been running all North American operations in conjunction with Bob Lutz. It didn't work. I mean, they lost market share. Of course, Gary wasn't the only one that lost market share for them. But he went back to manufacturing, and
that was his main thing.
Well, that's his gig.
And plus, I think he's been ready to go.
Right. But you also talk about Bob Lutz putting his stamp on the brands. But this higher management level, this looks like Fritz Henderson's stamp being put on the company. They're going, okay, who are the people that I can trust that are with me versus the people who maybe were more tied into Rick Wagner, who I didn't necessarily see eye to eye with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see, you know, going back to Cowger for a minute, I was surprised that he actually stayed on at the company. You know, usually when an executive is handed a demotion, they leave. But obviously, Cowger thought that it was still pretty valuable for him to be there. And I got to believe the same with Ed Pieper, you know, to say, hey, I'm general manager of Chevrolet one day and sales manager at Cadillac. That sounds like a demotion. It may not really be in terms of what he really will do, but it sure sounds like
it. No, it is. I mean, it is. But, you know, Ed's a loyal guy, and he, you know, he looks at it, I'm sure, as an opportunity. So,
well, you know, will this change GM's perception? And Art, I want to get you to talk about a story that I find fascinating. Yeah. You did a marketing clinic a couple of years ago in, I think, L.A., where you popped the badges off a Chevy and a Toyota and switched the badges. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, we do that, sure. And we actually, we do that every year. And what we do is we eliminate all of the badging from specific cars, and we go cross-brand. And then what we do is we try to see if people who, and especially works in Los Angeles, you get in it, they drive it, they feel the dashboard, they feel the seats, they see what the vehicle is all about, and then we ask them who made it. And General Motors products at the time, especially Ford, though, but General Motors products at the time, a lot of them actually were getting Toyota, not Honda, but Toyota names. People thought they were Toyotas in many cases. Some of the Hyundai products, you could pretty much tell the Hyundai products were actually, at that time, and this is, again, the most recent one, which was just done this year, Hyundai products, people were thinking were Hondas. They were thinking they were Toyotas. They were thinking they were anything but Hyundais. The Malibu came across just incredibly in terms of people thinking that they were easily Toyotas, Hondas, all sorts of other products like that. Things that were totally out of their, you know, that they wouldn't perceptually think that was the case. So I think Detroit, in many cases, has wound up getting the bad rep that it doesn't deserve. Certainly doesn't deserve as much as it used to. Once people start to get exposed to those vehicles, and they start to get exposed to the brands, they in real life, and Ford is a good example of this, people start to consider those products. Ford right now is just high on consideration lists. The number of people who were legacy buyers, you know, my dad owned a Ford, my grandfather owned a Ford, the legacy buyers at Ford is way down as a share of total reasons for buying a particular brand or buying Ford brand. And that's really important because that means that you're getting people who were not legacy buyers to come in and actually consider a particular brand, and that's what's happening at Ford right now.
Hey, Art,
has been for the last year and a half.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you a question about Ford. Is one of the reasons there because they're not taking government money? Because I've talked to a few people about that, and there seems to be some sort of buzz developing there. Is that a reason that people are putting them back on the list?
Yeah, in fact, one of the stories that we ran just a couple of not this issue, but the issue before, specifically showed that Ford was getting about. Winning not only high consideration because it didn't take it, General Motors was losing consideration because it did. Same with Chrysler. Chrysler considerations are always weak anyway, so that's really immaterial. But certainly when it came to General Motors, there was a loss. But Ford, yeah, has been gaining. A lot of people brought that up as the primary reason for even considering a Ford, is that it was still independent, wasn't government run. The products were good. There was about the products, and they liked it.
But Art, what's that say about what the Detroit 3 have got to do when you show them a Malibu and they think it's a Toyota and they think it's terrific, and then you tell them it's a Chevrolet and they lose interest in the car?
Well, it's funny. They didn't lose interest in the car. They were surprised. And the biggest concern is, well, if I'm not in the market for a Malibu, I would be interested in a Chevrolet product. Are the other Chevrolet products this good? And it really, what it comes down to, and I think it really worked extremely well, but they didn't follow through on it. The Howie Long commercials were extremely good in turning people's attitudes around. We do focus groups all the time, and it turned people's attitudes around about Chevrolet almost on the spot. The problem that General Motors has is there isn't any consistency, long-term consistency in their market. It winds up being, you know, maybe in Detroit they'll play it over and over and over again. But let me tell you get outside of Detroit, you don't commercials very often. And I think there's a lot of the momentum that they might gain from something like this marketing effort. They just lose it. It just dissipates.
Well,
I'm sorry, Peter.
No, it's okay. But you bring up a good point. I mean, Detroit's notorious for a very short attention span. I mean, when you're in the trenches and you're working with these companies and you're at an ad agency, you work on a campaign for almost a year. That means everybody has had their pound of flesh from that campaign, and you finally get it to the point where it's you're showing at the dealer show, the announcement show, and it's just like, God, we're almost there. It gets on the air. Well, guess what happens? To the Detroit executive's mindset, they've been looking at that campaign for a year. They forget that it's going across the country for the first time. And right away, in about 30 days, they're looking at their watches saying, well, what do you guys got up next? And Detroit's been guilty of that forever. They just don't get the importance of focused consistency over time in this image wrangling business. They just don't get it. And I've called the GM challenge the toughest job in marketing history to get people to consider GM again.
Maybe Howie Long should have appeared before Congress.
No, we talked about that. Lutz should have definitely been there.
Yeah. Lutz and Howie. So Art, what else do they have to do? Because, I mean, what you're saying, in certain product lines, they get very good consideration as long as people are not aware that it's a Detroit brand.
Well, it's more than just it not being a Detroit brand. It's being exposed to it. And Peter is absolutely right. You can't run a particular marketing campaign for a month or 6 weeks, get bored with it and move on to something else. Detroit, the product is coming. I mean, the product is either there or it's coming. And Ford is a good example of that. The Malibu is a perfect example of that. Really good car. The reality is, though, that there isn't enough exposure in the key markets. And the key markets are in the Smile States. Be honest, California all the way through Florida and up the East Coast. Or the Mid-Atlantic region. That's make or breaker territory. California, even in the midst of its economic problems right now, we saw in the focus groups there that Malibu, Flex, Fusion, all got high consideration marks in the focus groups. And we had them there with comparing other products. And we don't do this, by the way, with any of the car companies. We do this all independently. And, you know, I'll tell you, it really comes down to getting people in the cars, and it's word of mouth. Word of mouth, as Peter knows, is critical. It's key.
It's still the most powerful.
You get people talking about it.
Go ahead.
Still the most powerful there is.
Yeah, it's still the most powerful form of advertising there is. Absolutely.
You know, I'm looking up the numbers right now as we speak, because I think, let's see, Fusion did 18,000 plus sales last month. Malibu did 11,000. So Malibu was out a year ahead of the Fusion, got Car of the Year award, blah, 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 blah. And here Ford does a nice facelift, but it's a facelift of the Fusion, and pow, go sailing right past them. I wonder if that's one of the reasons why Ed Pieper's not running Chevrolet.
Well, frankly, Ford advertising was better. GM, they did the Big Bang Theory launch on Malibu and discovered, wow, it really works when you spend $100 million on something like Toyota does regularly. But then, bang, they were out of money. I saw Malibu print ads, but I don't recall Malibu TV. There was no, it's just like, okay, we launched that. It was pretty good. That's great. Let's move on to the next. No. I mean, the mindset has to be what the Asians and the Germans have brought to this business, and that is we got to hit. Now we're going to refine it. We're going to make it better, and we're going to never let it leave the consciousness of the consumer. But that's what happened with Malibu. And here's Fusion, brand new advertising campaign, and they stick with it, and they run it, and they're consistent, and it's paying off for Ford in the market. That's a good car, too. I mean, let's not forget, Fusion's an excellent car.
It is an excellent car. But to give Chevrolet its due, the Traverse is handily outselling the Flex.
Well, now, there's an interesting thing. Now, I actually think Ford was getting a little concerned about the Flex at launch because it just didn't meet their sales projections. But now, from what I can glean, the Flex is slowly starting to build, as, and Art knows this, as the Flex is exposed in the Smile States, people realize it's the wagon that they've been missing, even though nobody wants to call it a wagon. Wow, station wagon's a bad thing. No, I think station wagon's a good thing. Mm-hmm. When people get exposed to it and the versatility of it and the fact that it's not like a teeter-totter and you're not up sitting high. You are sitting high, but it's not like a SUV. I think when people are exposed to Flex, and I think Art was saying that in his groups that's, you know, that's coming out, they really like it.
Well, that's California audience too, right, Art? I mean, is it with a different audience?
Yeah, and
go ahead.
What we're seeing basically is that Ford has been very good. It used to be that Fords would launch, they'd have big sales, and then it would drop off. If you look at most of the Ford products that are really popular now, they started off the way Flex is starting off. It starts off, and this really happened with the original Taurus.
Right.
It started off slow, built, and then became part of the landscape. It became something that everybody started to consider, or at least a sizable percentage of people started to consider. And I think that's what's going on with Flex. There's the only problem with Flex really is how it photographs. And people don't realize that it's a big vehicle. When we did the youth market thing, they all loved the pictures. They all liked all of the stuff about it. And then they came back and they told us, you know what? It's got one too many seats, and it's $10,000 too expensive. Well, that's fine. That's not the audience for the Flex.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just a case of making sure that the marketing hits on the particular audience that they're looking for. People who have them love them. When we do the follow-ups on a lot of those products, and especially the Flex. Boy, it's going to be tough to get them out of that vehicle next time around.
Between the Flex and the Traverse, I also think it takes a little longer for people to get the Flex. The Traverse is a little more white bread, a more conventional-looking vehicle. The Flex, I found when I had one, once people experienced it, it was wow. But until that, they had never heard of the vehicle. They didn't know anything about it. The Traverse is another Chevy. It's okay. We go to our Chevy dealer. Hey, they've got one of those. That's cool. But the Flex, I think people will seek out, and I think it has legs.
Yes, it does.
Hey, and Peter, you mentioned a minute ago how good the Europeans are doing with their consistency and all, which brings me to another news topic that we got to talk about of NHTSA coming out this week and saying, it's not going to let companies that do not meet the CAFE standard merely pay a fine and keep on going, because they've collected almost $800 million in fines over the last, I don't know, two decades, mainly from BMW, Mercedes, and Porsche.
I think it's 99% of the German cars.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean,
say hello to your shiny, happy, smiley cars, folks.
I mean, I would think this is going to hurt those brands if all of a sudden, because it's mainly their halo car.
Oh yeah,
that can't meet the gas.
Because they need some breathing room to make the new standards. I mean, this transition is going to be painful for them, and if they can't, you know, just pay a fine, we might have limited choices. Right now, we seem to have every, you know, niche covered by the German. Mercedes and BMW seem to have a different car coming out every week. But that's probably going to go away. They're probably going to be much more restrictive. We're not going to have as many choices. And because unless there's another compromise reached to in lieu of a fine, I mean, what else can they do? Plant trees? I don't know. You know.
Refuse to make the vehicles legal in the United States.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
That's probably the option that they have. Do you think this could be a gift from the government to the domestic automakers? Because it impacts the high-end European brands more?
Well, you know, that's a good point, because there are, I don't think, any vehicles in the Chrysler lineup that are hit with a gas guzzler tax except for the Viper.
I was going to say the Viper.
I don't think Ford has anything. Well, probably Mustang Shelby is got it. And at GM, probably the V-Series at Cadillac.
And the ZR1.
And the ZR1. And, you know, I think the ZR1, I'm not sure if that has a gas guzzler. I'm not.
Yeah, I don't remember because it gets such great highway mileage.
Right, right. But, you know, they've always had an understood rule within the big three. We are never going to sell a car that has a gas guzzler tax. And then after too many other competitors did it, they threw in the towel and said, you know, for certain halo cars, you got to be competitive.
Well, let's hope a compromise is reached. Otherwise, the darkness will fall over the land.
Yeah. Art, what do you make of that? What happens if the Germans have got to limit certain models because otherwise they'd be slapped with cafe fines?
I think that you'd wind up with a Mercedes Nano. You know, the people who are paying it don't mind paying it. They understand what it is. They don't care. But there aren't enough of them to form any kind of a coalition to do anything about it. I think this is totally up to the Germans to deal with. I think it's going to wind up being that. And I don't think they're going to have – the only recourse they have is to go through you know, go through their own government bureaucracy and try and somehow lobby against it. But
You make a good point, Art. I mean, it might come down to like diplomacy.
Yeah. Yeah. Chicken tax time.
Hey, another topic, Art. Somebody told me that you told them that you think the cash for clunkers bill is skewed in favor of pickup trucks. Is that right? Did I hear right?
I didn't say it was skewed in favor of pickup trucks. I said that basically there are a lot of guys who are out there who are going to wind up taking their really old, and there's plenty of them in many of the rural and semi-rural areas, old pickup trucks, and take advantage of cash for clunkers with, you know, for good reason. I mean, you're talking about some of these vehicles, you know, are old enough. They certainly meet the criteria. They're junk because they've been basically work trucks forever. So you're looking at farmers, ranchers, a lot of contractors who have at least one or two that easily aren't worth more than $50 that could qualify. And they're always looking, and they've come back to the market looking for more pickups, replacing pickups because the deals have been so good. Well, here's just another spiff in order to make the deal even better. And they have the old vehicles to trade in because they're just sitting out there. You can just see them anywhere. So is it skewed towards pickups? No. Will pickup truck owners take advantage of it? Certainly the rural ones will.
And where's the market going, Art? I mean, you track sales real closely. And I was encouraged when we saw, you know, March sales better than February, April better than March, May better than April. And then we hit June and sales are down again. Is this a lull in the action, or is this a sign that maybe the market really is not recovering?
Well, the market was recovering. The problem is that you're looking at the people who buy cars, for the most part, tend to be upper middle. When you get outside, again, you got to get outside of certain markets like the Detroit market, wherever. But basically, you're looking at people that are making a household income is 110 and up. That tends to be the new car market. 60,000 individual, 110 family. The problem is those people are just scared to death about what's going to happen to their taxes. We do a jitters index every month. These are home-centric concerns, confidence, if you want to call it that. But they're home-centric. And let me tell you, in the 20 years we've been doing that, 20-something years we've been doing that, federal taxes have never gone over, it's a 10-point scale, 10 being absolute worst. It's never gone over 7.5 or 8. This last year, it's gone to over 9. These people are just not going to spend money if they think their stocks are stinky, if they think that there's, you know, bigger taxes on the horizon. They've already lost the equity in their house, so they can't think of California, where a third of all of the cars that are bought with home equity loans. You have no equity, you don't buy a car. So, you know, there's all sorts of things that are going on. Is it a blip? It would not have been a blip if it weren't for all of this most recently, the most recent talk about all of these additional taxes that those folks who buy cars are concerned and actually fear.
Wow, that I hadn't put one and one together on that one. That's pretty interesting.
You know, it's going to be interesting. All right, you mentioned this market. This traditionally is one of the most warped markets on earth because
the Detroit market.
Yeah, because 95% of the people know someone who can get a number for to get a deal on a car. Well, a lot of those people are gone, and a lot of those deals are gone with them. So maybe Detroit will actually start to creep back to being more of a truer market than it used to be. Because before, I never forget when I first got in the business, I heard some executives say something about some car had to have been a Pontiac or something. Selling pretty well. And I just thought for a moment, I said, yeah, but they're all company cars. How can you say that?
Right.
How are they selling in Cincinnati? But maybe that's finally coming to a halt because, let's face it, the deals are gone. The people are gone. So, now we're seeing a lot more Hyundais like everybody else in the country.
I know when Ford bought Jaguar, Jaguar of Troy became the number one Jaguar dealer in the world.
Because
all the company cars.
Yeah. And I remember Alan Mulally, he commented when he got to Ford, he went to the executive garage and he said, where are all the Fords? We're in the Ford business here. What's going on? That changed quickly.
Yeah. Jeff, you were, at Ford this week. What's your impression? I mean, the company announced a profit.
Yeah, they announced a profit.
Right.
But you know what? This is one of those stories that was really difficult to tell on the radio. You say, okay, they announced a profit, but it was really a loss. But even though it was a loss, it was good news.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't a bad loss.
Because it wasn't a bad loss.
Right.
So the bottom line is they're showing progress. I think it's amazing that most of the country really doesn't understand what's going on at Ford. They just think, oh, Ford's doing good because they don't have to take money because Bill Ford has a lot of money stashed in his mattress or something like that. They don't realize the whole, how they went to the open market a couple of years ago and they have loan money. But Ford has done a masterful job of spinning this so that the world thinks they're a different car maker, that they're doing well, and it was good news today. Perfect news? No, they still have debt issues. They still have a really lousy market overall, but they've got some pretty decent products out there and they've got some momentum.
You know what stood out in my mind is they lost, 424 million dollars
operating loss.
Operating loss. And yet, the revenue for the quarter fell $11 billion. So that tells me if the market comes back a little bit, let's say they only get half of that. Instead of $11 billion, let's say they get $5 billion back. This company is going to be obscenely profitable.
Well, we've talked about that. We're figuring in 2011, 12, 13, if the market does come back and with all these car companies restructured, the profits are going to be monumental.
Monumental.
Well, I think a lot of other people are figuring that because I was watching Ford stock today, and it is was sort of the reverse ski slope effect because that's what auto stocks about. I've called that the ski slope effect, chung, like that. It was reversed today. It just all of a sudden climbed 10-12%, settled in a little under $7 a share. This is a stock that was selling for what did it bottom out at? A buck and a quarter,
yeah.
Something
about
like
that. Right.
So if we'd have mortgaged our houses. Bought all Ford stock, if we'd have survived the nervous breakdown that we had in the middle,
that's right.
We'd be doing good.
Right. Have the cast iron lining put in your stomach because the ulcer would have burned right through. But and then Hyundai posted an all-time record net profit for the second quarter today as well. So that surprised me. I was... And, again, I don't know if Korean accounting methods allow them to play around with things more or not, but still, all-time record profit in this market.
Their sales have been strong. They've got new products. I assume that includes Kia. Some of Kia's new products are pretty cool out there. The Genesis is good, and some of the low-end stuff is good, so they're on a roll.
Well, I don't know if they're making money in the U.S. I think most of their profits coming from Korea, China, and India, and probably other developing markets that have not cratered. But nonetheless, for anybody to turn a profit in this kind of market, I don't care where they are in the world, that's
Yeah.
That's where you got to sit up and start paying attention.
Yeah, absolutely.
So did you get a chance to drive the Ford EV?
Yes. I drove it at the auto show. I didn't drive it this weekend.
Okay.
I drove it before.
The electric Focus.
Yeah, the electric Focus.
I liked it.
It's a cool vehicle. It's fun to drive electric cars, but there are a lot of things that are fun to drive, but when it comes to actually deciding to write a check and deciding to spend your money to buy it and how well it fits in your lifestyle, it's still a niche product, but the torque is great. I love that quiet sound, the cool futuristic whir. It's really...
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. The price. They told me the battery right now is almost $30,000. So, Art, we've got to ask you that. You're the guy doing all the marketing survey and all that. Are Americans going to buy electric cars?
Secondary vehicles, yeah. One in four new car intenders say they're looking for something other than just gas, or in addition to whether it's a hybrid or a diesel or an electric. They have the same problems or the same concerns that they've always had about electrics, range, just the whole cost structure, the way it's priced, all of that kind of stuff. But there's a certain percentage that clearly would buy them.
Now these
big
are people.
Percentage. Now you're looking at me.
Yeah, these are people, Art, who are intenders. But what about when they? Okay, they love the theory of an electric car. They love the idea of I plug it in. I don't have to go to the gas station. Things like that. But once they get to the dealership and find out the reality of what the expense is like, what the range is really like, things of that nature, does that intention fall off?
Yeah, in fact, we break it down by $5,000 increments. And once you start seeing an electric at 15 or 20 or 25, you're looking at about 2.5% to 4% of the market potentially. But boy, every $5,000 increase in that is about 1.5% off of the total market share. So, if you had electrics that are averaging $35,000 to $40,000, don't expect to see very large market share, 1.5%. And that's coming from somebody that used to drive an electric in Los Angeles back and forth to work every day.
What? You did what?
I had a converted version of an old, yeah. Oh, yeah. This is back in, I got pictures of it. I had a converted, did 60 miles an hour. It would go 40 miles. I was 18 miles from work, round trip every day, 60 miles an hour on the freeways in Los Angeles went. At the time, you could actually do 60 miles.
Back in the 20th century.
Yeah.
Mid-20th century.
What did you convert?
Mid-20th century.
What did you convert?
It was the Renault R10, and it was great. I mean, all the batteries. I had a guy follow me all the way home on the freeway because it said electric on the side. He followed me all the way home and swore it was gasoline powered because he said electric cars can't go that fast. And I had him look underneath the hood. He looked under the seats. He was looking for the motor. I mean, he was looking for the engine, the gas engine. And it was a great car. And it was built by a couple of buddies of mine. And that's what they were doing. One guy held the land speed record for electrics up until about 1992. But they know what they were doing. And they have use. They have a use. But most consumers are not going to necessarily find that use to be sufficient.
I think
especially when you start talking about a $35,000 secondary car in the household.
Yeah, I think they're going to be concentrated in urban areas. I mean, there's no question of that.
Well, urban areas where you can plug something in because, most people in cities park on the street or in garages that don't have electrical outlets handy.
Yeah, I get an email about every other week from a New York readers who say, what the hell am I going to, where am I going to plug that thing in on 39th Street? I mean, what are you guys smoking over there, I got no answers for those people. I said, well, they're going to put little meters up that all the taxpayers are going to pay for.
So, Art, then plug-ins are the obvious solution as an interim to, until EVs are affordable?
Yeah, plug-ins are going to wind up having to be the transition vehicle, just like hybrids are a transition vehicle. It'll eventually wind up being that there'll be a, as you know, and as you guys talk about all the time, there's going to be a big mix of different kinds of power plants, and people are going to buy vehicles depending on, as they do now, depending on the use that they need to put that vehicle to. Sure. I mean, if you can get 35, 40 miles out of a battery charge and you live 10 miles from work, you'll use it every day. Park it in the garage and plug it in. No big deal. But you're not going to take it to, you're not going to take it to,
Jellystone.
Yeah, or Jellystone.
And I think that's what you get with people. Things sound wonderful in theory. It sounds like a great idea. And then when you really look at, okay, how does this fit with my life, with how much money I'm going to have to pay for it, how I'm going to have to recharge it, what I'm really going to use it for, then the interest starts to wane. And that's the same thing with a sports car. I'm driving a Mazda Miata this week. This is a wonderful vehicle. I love nothing more than two-seat open-air roadsters, but I'd never buy one because it just doesn't fit into my lifestyle. I could never justify spending that money for just a sunny day car, particularly here in Michigan.
Right? Oh, come on, John. You can do it.
Well, John can do it, just not me.
John's going to be an early adopter of a Volt, he's already said.
Yeah, although, I had an interesting conversation with...
Yeah, but you can deduct the price. I mean, that's work-related for you.
Hey, I never thought of that. I like that idea. You want to be my tax accountant?
Sure.
You signed the papers.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I had an interesting discussion with Sue Sischke, who runs Ford's environmental stuff. And she was saying she thinks going with a series hybrid, which what the Volt is, she says that's a mistake. And I said, why? And she said, because it's great for the EV mode. You can take it up to top speed. You can floor it, and the engine never comes on. But after that, after you go your 40 miles or you get 50% discharge in the batteries, the engine's going to run. It's going to run, in fact, until you turn the thing off and plug it in again to recharge it. So she says, we think it's better to have an engine on board that is connected to the wheels, so that when you really floor it, the engine comes on. When you go over 40 miles an hour, the engine comes on. But below 40 miles an hour, and you can put your foot into it because I drove their plug-in. They had that this week for us to drive. You can accelerate fairly briskly in Ford's plug-in Escape hybrid without having the engine kick in. But her whole point was, if you want to go pure EV for 40 miles under all conditions, you need a big battery pack, hence the $10,000 that GM's talking about just for the battery. So her whole argument is you can go with a smaller battery pack, less mass, less packaging space, handles better, certainly less cost. So now...
Well, that's the Japanese mode.
Well, that's the Toyota model,
right.
You bet. Not the Honda model, because Honda still doesn't do strong hybrids. You cannot go in pure EV mode in the Honda hybrids.
Yeah.
So just kind of interesting. But we should... We should start talking about rapid fire. We need to get the list out.
Oh,
here.
Yeah. I'll be glad to dole them out.
Art, you got to stick around for rapid fire with us.
Okay, I will do that.
Hey, one thing I got to – what are all your clinics showing of the Taurus? We on our TV program this weekend, we've got the chief exterior designer, the chief interior designer, and the marketing guy coming on for the Taurus. But what's your research show about it?
Real positive attitude towards it. People like now they've seen photos and all of that, and they do like it. So I think they probably have one of those consistent long term winners with what they're doing. That's the response that we're getting back anyway.
Peter, what do you make of the car, the Taurus?
I think Alan Mulally's going to be right about the name. I think there's some residual goodness out there still for the name. And I think people are kind of shocked that it's that good. And I think it's the new mainstream full-size American car all over again. It might be a slow build, like we're talking about the Flex, but I think it's too good of a car, too much content. Too well executed for it not to be a winner.
I love the car. Beautiful, especially inside. It's got a great interior, and my only concern is it may be too nice to be a Taurus, because my memory of Taurus, even during the good days, is more Fusion kind of size car, more mass market, and I'm wondering if it's a little too upscale to begin with. But other than that, it's a beautiful vehicle.
It is, and I agree totally with you. The interior, one thing that a couple of things that I thought were really cool is the console really leans forward and it's very high. It's almost like a table inside there. And you'll notice there are no cut lines. It's the dash sweeps totally into the console with no cut lines at all. And I asked them, how do you do that? And they said, well, everybody else in the business has a supplier assemble a console. It comes into the plant, you snap it into place, so you've got the cut lines where it butts up against it. In this, they actually assemble the console in the car. I mean, they literally bring all the parts in and they assemble it in there, which is, I mean, for a mass market American car, that's just not done. And so that tells me they're doing some really good stuff with their manufacturing people, design and manufacturing working together. And the other thing that I love is in the middle of the dashboard is a speaker grill. And it looks like a wire mesh, but it's not. It's a plastic molding. But to make it look like a wire mesh, the holes in the mesh, each and every one of them had to be individually designed. It's not like you design one hole and cut and paste the whole thing to get this. Each one had to be individually designed because it's a convex molding. And to have everything in the right proportion from top to bottom, they had to do each one individually. And it's like, geez, man, it's been a while since we've seen the American companies put that kind of detail into their interiors.
Well, to Jeff's point, though, if they hadn't done it, then it would have been open to criticism. So, yeah, maybe it reaches a little too much over the old one, but I think it's better to be that way than if they kept it at a lower level and they just said, well, it really is better than you think. But they just thought, we're going to show them once and for all that it is, in fact, better than you think.
All right, we have the rapid-fire questions. Okay, Goat Rope asks, are you still catching heat for your dust-to-dust energy report that shows that a Lexus RX hybrid uses 30% more energy in its lifetime than an Escalade or a Land Cruiser? And Art, you know that question is for you.
Yes, we still are getting heat. Yes, the crazies are still out there. That's the reason that I live in the woods.
And just so people know, Art did a fascinating study that looked at the total life cycle energy usage of a vehicle, including all the energy needed to manufacture it and operate it and recycle it. And you found that hybrids aren't that efficient.
No, in fact, they're not. The reality is complexity adds energy requirements and, you know, hybrids are complex.
And GoRope, you don't have to answer this, wants to know if you got invited to the Slate Magazine holiday party. Okay, Asian Martin asks, Art, I know you have a couple of hot rods and several Harleys, but what do you drive on a regular basis?
Oh, I drive a Ford Crown Vic Interceptor motor, flame side exhaust, the biggest glass sunroof you have ever seen. And that's my daily driver.
Cap.
It actually wheels, tires, the whole thing.
Cap tires,
no,
cap
it's not
suspension.
Cap. Yeah. It's sweet. It's a sweet ride. Nobody knows what it is because nobody's ever seen a Crown Vic like that. And they're all cop cars and taxi cabs.
Cool.
Okay, Mitch Weaver asks, and this is for you, Peter. He says, Peter, explain the grown-up clothes, please.
I came from a business meeting, and I didn't want to change in the parking lot, so I've just left my suit on.
Okay. Matt Boshi asks, other than Brian Nesbitt becoming GM of Cadillac, general manager of Cadillac, what do you think was the biggest surprise today regarding the wholesale changes within the executive ranks at General Motors?
For me, I said it before, the departure of Troy Clark.
Yeah?
That wasn't a surprise, but I think Brent Dewar coming back was a surprise.
I think Brian Nesbitt, but he says other than that.
Yeah.
That was mine. Joseph asks, everyone's fawning over the Ford unveiling. One, does Ford have any cars that meet the upcoming cafe? Two, will the Focus Coupe Cabriolet come here? Three, where does a $40,000 Taurus show leave Lincoln? So Ford, does it have cars that meet the upcoming cafe?
Absolutely.
You bet it does.
Yes, it does.
Not as many as a lot of them, too.
Right. Now, remember, not every single car has to meet the 35 mile per gallon CAFE. It's spread over the fleet, but the new Fiesta will blow through those numbers very easily. The next generation Focus will easily blow through those numbers. And you watch, the Fusion's going to be there, and I'm not talking about the hybrid version either. It's going to do it. Okay, Focus Coupe Cabriolet come here. I don't think so.
It's been asked before, and
yeah,
they said
know.
No, so I don't. Yeah.
Yeah, we're hoping for, what is it, the SVT? What do they call it?
SRT there?
No, no, not
that's,
SVT.
That's Chrysler,
what's the British one?
ST?
The RS.
RS. RS. We're hoping, yeah, whatever you know we're talking about, that's what we hope comes.
The RS.
RS. And a $40,000 show, where does that leave Lincoln?
Well, that just... put more stuff
well,
on
it. Well, let's put this in perspective. Mr. Spinella, what is the average MSRP today?
The average MSRP is around 34. Average transaction price is right around 29.
See, most people don't know that. When you tell them the average price of a car today is $34,000, they're shocked.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize the transaction price was up to 29. Art, I thought that was just about 26.
No, it was, but once again, what we're seeing is even at the low end of the market, people are actually loading up a lot of the smaller cars with a lot of options, running those transaction prices up.
And that's an issue with a number of the Lincoln products. I had the Fusion and the MKZ back-to-back, and I had one of the top-level trims of the Fusion, and there really isn't that much difference. There's some, and I have not been in the MKT yet, but the Flex is such a nice vehicle. I wonder, okay, you know, they say, oh, no, this is different. It has more upscale material. Yeah, to a designer, but to an average person who's sitting in a car, it's harder to make the case for a Lincoln versus a Ford product when a vehicle like a Flex, for example, is so nice.
Right. And Ben tells me we have a call from Sherelle Patterson about whether or not Ford's an import. Let's run that that phone in right now.
I was just at the Ford dealer and noticed that all of the cars' American parts content is under 75%. And EPA standards say that under 75% they're classified as an import. What reason would we have to buy a Ford vehicle over, say, a Toyota product that has more than 75%. Thank you.
It doesn't?
No.
No, it doesn't.
Wait, what?
Every time you look at any of the real numbers on that, the Toyota is running right around 39 to 42, depending on whose number you want to use. The whole thing is crazy. You had this conversation last week, John, and it was about, you know, how do you define an import or a domestic? And you used what I thought was a really good example, and that's the intellectual property. Where is the intellectual property? And I've always used, where do the profits go?
I agree.
If the profits go to Dearborn.
Absolutely.
Then that's fine. I mean, you know, if the profits all go there and the intellectual property, and it pays for the intellectual property, then it's a domestic car company. If Toyota built every car that they did here and they sent all of the dollars back to Japan, we get no benefit. I mean, I don't mean it that in that way. I mean, we don't get the profit benefit because the intellectual property winds up still being in Japan.
Yeah, it's where the profits go. That's people have been asking me that for 10 years. It's where the profits go.
Well, we didn't talk a whole lot about Wendelin Wiedeken getting fired from Porsche, but JJ asks, why celebrate Wiedeken's firing? He loved Porsche, and Piëch is an ass.
Well, I got a problem with Wiedeken because, you know, he was canonized by the German media, which they have to canonize their executives. I don't know why, but that's just the way the German automotive media is. But this guy played in an arena he had no business playing, and he got his ass handed to him, so he should be gone. I mean, you don't go against Piëch in that. If you're going to play against Piëch, you better be ready, and he wasn't ready. He got hosed. But are we to cry for him? No, he's dragged down like something like $300 million out of Porsche personally the last 3 years.
Yeah, my whole take on Piëch is or on Wedekind is I think he did wonderful things for Porsche. And then he got greedy. He wanted to take over Volkswagen.
Yeah.
He ran up $9 billion in debt getting the money to try to take over Volkswagen. For what? For what?
Yeah.
Now, now he's leaving Porsche. It's going to get taken over by VW.
Yeah.
And there's a pile of debt. So get the guy out of there.
Yeah. And besides, he thought he could overcome the Klinkian nightmare with Colonel Klink. You know, it's not going to work.
Okay, Bill Bowen asks, I wonder how much Bob Lutz influenced the decision of the new guy at Cadillac, the new head guy at Cadillac. Wonder if he worked with that fellow when he was at Chrysler.
Yeah, about 100%.
About 100%, yeah, yeah. Lutz plucked Brian Nesbitt out of nowhere and gave him a great project at Chrysler to do. And then when Lutz went to GM, made sure that Brian came over there. So big time, yeah. Let's see, what else? Oh, Rumblestrip asks, question for Art. Wouldn't contractors or people who buy trucks for work like a half ton with a diesel rather than having to buy a three-quarter ton to get it?
No. When you look at the contractor market especially, the contractor market are all into the 250, 350 range anyway. If there were a diesel 150, they probably would ignore it. Based on a lot of the surveys that we do, the real key audience for a half-ton diesel winds up really being the towing market, the individual market, not the work truck market.
Okay, Scott in Cleveland asks.
Scotty.
Just wondering, since I saw one on the road today, is the Dodge Journey a design from the Daimler days or the Cerberus days?
No, it was in place before Cerberus got there.
Yeah, it was before Cerberus got there. It was the Daimler days. When Dieter Zetsche and Wolfgang Bernhard were still running Chrysler, two guys who I liked a lot, but man, that's when they did product design on a cheapo budget. I think the Journey's a pretty nice vehicle from a packaging standpoint and from a driving standpoint.
It's just not finished well.
Oh my God, it just needs a do-over.
They don't execute.
No,
they
don't.
And if you don't execute in this market, then you're not going to make it.
Okay, Raging Pitbull asks, do you think there's a possibility for the Solstice to live on as a Buick? How about naming that the Skylark? That's pretty clever.
That's hurt.
I doubt it.
Well, is there any chance of the Solstice living on?
No.
Yeah. All right, you don't see any chance, do you?
No, not really.
If I had the money, I'd make a deal with GM. Give me your build out of the Solstice, and I'd put 7-liter Corvette motors in them.
You know what? I had a chance a month or so ago to drive a Solstice and a Sky. And as I said, I'm driving a Miata this week. And after having them almost back to back, you can see a difference between how much more refined the Miata is, how much smoother it is, how much better the engine sounds, how much better the gear shifts, just right on down the line. I mean, the Solstice was fun. It was a nice vehicle, but I think they'd have to seriously upgrade it if they want to call it a Buick.
It never had a pleasant engine sound. You know, it really didn't.
No, it's direct injection engine.
I mean, there were more dulcet tones coming from a Briggs & Stratton.
Yeah. Dr. Botox asks, what's Kia's identity these days? This must be a question that we didn't get to last week. What is the Kia identity these days? Is it luxury, performance, safety, style?
Cheap. Still. I mean, Hyundai's got...
Still.
Yeah, Hyundai's got more of a, you know, they're getting there with the image thing. But Kia, to me, still is a deal. I mean, until proven otherwise, I think.
I just had the Kia Soul, though, and not a bad vehicle.
No,
I
mean,
I was just going to point that out, that's very un-Kia-like.
Yeah, but they've got a way to go. They would need Soul, and then the next vehicle would have
Forte,
to be... Yeah.
And the Forte, I think, looks terrific.
Yeah, and maybe that's where they're going, but they're not there yet.
No, not there, right. MP asks, is there any cost advantage in the design, manufacturing, and maintenance of front-wheel drive cars versus rear-drive cars? Why are the majority of cars front-wheel drive?
Art.
Fanaticism. it's quite honestly, when front-wheel drive, there were a lot of us, I was on the Detroit beat at the time, there were a lot of us who were wearing T-shirts that just said rear-wheel drive because we wanted it to come back.
Yeah.
It became kind of a thing to do. And everybody went to it because of the packaging. Everybody thought cars were going to get smaller. They didn't. I mean, you know, look at the Taurus was supposed to be the Crown Vic, if you recall. Well, not the Taurus. I don't remember at this point. But at any rate, no. It's there's no practical advantage other than snowy weather kind of advantages, and that for the most part has been dealt with.
Well, front-wheel drive, I think, is definitely more costly to make, but it can be lighter.
Absolutely.
And you get better fuel economy as a result.
It's
costlier to repair.
Yeah. Right.
But the other thing is car companies have spent so much marketing money over the last 20, 30 years telling people that front-wheel drive is better in the snow, it's more fuel economy, that if you talk to somebody who doesn't really understand cars and isn't an aficionado, they'll tell you, well, why would I want a rear-wheel drive? I'll get stuck in the snow in that.
I'll never forget when GM launched the infamous X cars. There was one brief scene in the Citation spot with the Citation towing a small boat with the rear wheels off or something like that. It was just the front wheels were working and the rear wheels were gone, and it was pulling like a little rowboat or something. And I was like, golly, look at that, you know. the American manufacturers have basically brainwashed the American consumer that front-wheel drive is, you know, preferable. But, I mean, I don't know. We all grew up driving rear-wheel drive cars in the snow, and it didn't seem to be a problem back then. All of a sudden, now it's like hand-wringing. Oh, you can't leave the garage without it, you know. It's just, you're going to die. You're going to freeze to death.
Isn't that called advertising?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. But you're right. Yeah, we all survived for eons with rear drive cars with bias ply tires and no ABS or traction control or any of that stuff.
Yeah, you go throw on snow tires if you live in Wisconsin or up north and just, you know.
In fact, I love driving in the snow. It's the only time you can be going 10 tenths at 35 miles
an hour. That's how I learned car control. I remember. I can say this now because my parents are gone, but I used to take the cars out before I had my license, and I would practice car control in the snow, and I'd go up and stop and see a buddy of mine, Bill Hoffman, and we'd take his younger brother, Peter, and shove him in the back, and he would scream the entire time as I drifted from one corner to another. But that's how you learn how to car control.
Absolutely. That's how I learned.
Greatest thing.
All right, you guys want to see the Citation ad?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, Citation.
Producing the first Chevy of the 80s.
It's a Chevy like no Chevy.
Oh, wow, I remember this.
So thoroughly contemporary driving machine.
Chevy Citation.
A whole new kind of Chevy with a full of front-wheel drive.
Chevy Citation, room for five, front-wheel drive, and an EPA estimate of 24 miles a gallon. It's not only the first Chevy of the 80s, it's a whole new kind of compact car. Over the next few weeks, we're going to demonstrate all kinds of things the Chevy Citation can do.
It's the first Chevy of the
80s. Your Chevy dealers now for a Citation demonstration drive.
Chevy Citation.
Thank you, Michael. You're the man.
Yeah, Michael, that's excellent for
you're
getting that.
Man.
Jeez.
Wasn't it? I mean, God, it's like a different universe. So.
Well, you know what's weird is you look at that and you go, man, that's so old-fashioned. But I was there.
Yeah.
Well, we're at the top of the hour, so we've got to wrap this up here. Remember, again, you can call us anytime at 1-620-AUTO-LIN. That's out of line without the E. That's 1-620-288-6546. And that's, I'm just telling you that for next week's
that's
rapid fire.
That's the French auto line.
the French
auto line.
Right. And remember, we got our store up on our website. You can go buy all kinds of cool stuff, auto line t-shirts and hats.
What was
and mugs.
The gist of the contest?
Oh, yeah. No, we you missed the contest last week.
Well, because Ben made me bring in another shirt. Ben, was that shirt for you?
For our second grand prize winner.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because we had two guys who both came the closest. They picked 42 days, you know, based on the way we were measuring it. It was a 40-day bankruptcy. And we had two people that picked 42 days. They were the closest. And so we thought it wasn't fair to divide the prizes in half.
No,
we had to give them both, you know, the full prize.
Way to go, guys.
So yeah. Mr. Ratner and Mr. Bloom both won.
They're big fans of the show,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. They're getting their Auto Extremist t-shirts on.
That's right. And so, you know, thanks. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter. We're at twitter.com/outofline. You can follow Peter at twitter.com/autoextremist. And we've got yours, Jeff. You're at twitter.com/Jeffrey Gilbert.
And that's E-R-Y.
E-R-Y.
Yes.
Because there's another Jeffrey there.
That's right. No, because my mother couldn't spell.
Oh. Jeff Ferry.
Yes.
Art, you do any of that Twitter stuff or anything like that?
Not really.
Okay, then we won't promo you.
You're a good man, okay. Art. I've been chastised by the Twitter community for not Twittering enough, but oh well.
Chastising, I know.
And next week, we've got Kurt Ritter coming on the show. He's a longtime Chevrolet guy, put their whole Like a Rock campaign together, and now he's at Saatchi, L.A., doing the same thing for Toyota. So that ought to be an interesting discussion next week. So remember, you can subscribe at the iTunes Music Store, and we'll have everything posted later. But thank everybody for tuning in.
Visit our website, outofline.detroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Orange, purple, silver, and blue. Change of frequency.